Welcome to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. The fictioneers, the artists, the editors, and others. Brought to you by the PulpNet. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, over 100 episodes of this podcast, and much more at the PulpNet. Your link to the pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at ThePulp.net.
A Dan Turner line might go something like, "Behind me, a Roscoe sneezed ka-chow, and a lead pill split the ozone next to my noggin. I ankled the lot, my back pockets dipping gravel." What that meant was someone shot at him and he ran. You get the idea that he was parodying hard-boiled style. It was not parody. It was beyond parody. He wasn't making fun of anybody. He was just completely out there. It was amazing.
In this episode of Pulp Tales, author John Woolley and pulp historian and author Will Murray go under covers with the Spicy Detectives. This Pulp Tales was recorded at Pulp Fest 2024 in Pittsburgh on Thursday, August 1st, 2024. John begins.
Well, we're going to talk first. We're going to talk about the Spicy Detectives, which I will defer, except for Dan Turner, who I have some personal relationship with. I'm going to defer to Will on a lot of the Spicy Detectives because he's written a lot about them, and I really woodshedded reading Will's pieces on these Spicy Detectives because you got a ton of them. But I'd like, just in case, briefly, just in case you don't know about the origins of the Spicy Detective or the Spicy Pulps and how they were related to Superman DC Comics or DC Comics. You want to go into that a little bit, Will?
Well, Harry Donenfeld was the publisher. He had a printing shop called the Donnie Press, and he printed pulps and other magazines. And he partnered with Jack Leibowitz, who was his accountant, and they were doing what were then known as girly pamphlets, pap stories, spicy stories, and they were 15 cents. Might have been a little more. And they were little pamphlets of sex stories, but sex by the standards of the 1920s and early 30s, which was just titillation. I would love to know what motivated them. I can only guess for them to do something that now is very common, which is to mix genre stories with sexual situations. Now, today we don't think of it that way. We just think of genre stories that happen to be a little more open than they did in the movie days or the pulp days. I don't know what caused them to think of spicy detective stories, except they must have done it when the westerns were on a downswing and the pulps and the detectives were on the upswing, and they're thinking, what can we do to crack this market? Now, this would be the tail end of 33 into 34. They had a ton of writers writing for them for Pep and Spicy Stories and the other magazines they had at that time. I half suspect that maybe because this is before the Hays Code took control of Hollywood, they were seeing things on the screen that were, you know, genre stories, detective stories, but that had a certain amount of titillation. And most of the pulps wouldn't go there at that time. This is before the Shutter pulps, and Street and Smith would stay away from the stuff, and Munsey would stay away from sexual situations because a lot of their thinking was Victorian dime novel publisher thinking. And probably something they saw on the screen or thing said, let's try this. So I printed out an index the first year or so. And the first issue looks cobbled together. The lead story is by Norman A. Daniels, who had just broken into the field, what, in 32, 33, yeah, right. Writing gangster stories and some detective stuff. Then you've got a writer named Eric L. Schwartz, who was really Esther Schwartz, who is also Leslie Slate, who was in the first issue. You've got an Alvin Gray, a Jane Thomas, a John LeBaron, and one story by Robert Leslie Bellum, which is a standalone story. In the second issue, the lead story is by Bellum, and it's the first Dan Turner story. We've got another Norman Daniels, There's Bellum under another name. We got Robert Marks, which is also Daniels. We got the name Bernd Horn, who shows up a bit. We don't know who he is. C.C. Spruce, we don't know who he is. On to the third issue, Saul W. Paul, sounds like a pen name, but it's not. It's a real person. Another Daniels, another pseudonymous Bellum. And gradually, over the first year, they begin acquiring regular writers. Daniels switches to pen names because he sees some of the first issues of the magazine and says, I can't have my name attached to this stuff. C. Samuel Campbell was a real writer. There was a group of writers in Philadelphia who wrote for the Spices, and they all knew each other. And Arthur Humboldt, which I think is Robert Blackman, who was another newcomer. And here's the thing, the market, since it was dependent on sexual situations, which the editors could edit in if they had to, they probably bought some rejects and just punched them up, which is why you see some of these writers. Bellum starts to get very prolific very fast. With the sixth issue, E. Hoffman Price comes in, and he starts to produce series characters like
Cliff Cragen.
Cliff Cragen was the first one. Honest John Carmody was the other. The interesting thing about what Price did, and pulp writers loved it when a writer lived in an unusual place because he could write about it with authenticity. Price was living in New Orleans, which is probably the perfect city next to San Francisco and New York for Spicy's mystery story, detective story.
And so was Blasted Game, right? Yes. He shows up later. Why Blasted Game was in New Orleans?
I don't know that he was. You're probably right, yeah, but I know he was from the South. I just don't remember where. The interesting thing about Hoffman Price is he wrote a lot for the Spices while he was writing for other people. Very prolific in the Spices under his own name. And Hamilton Craigie, was that Hamilton Craigie? No, not Craigie. It's a name like that. It's on here. I'll find it. I'm a little punchy from being up very early and flying, which is, you know, par for the course. The writers start to become a team of sorts. People come, go. Some of them, real names we'll never know. Some of them are real names, we just don't know. It recently came out when a letter from Robert Leslie Bellum surfaced, and he happened to mention his good friend, who also lived in California, writing for the Spices, under the name Frank E. Marks. And he produced a series about a guy named Mace Mallory, about which I would be happy to tell you if I'd only read a Mace Mallory story, and if I'd only known that Frank E. Marks was really Kenneth Stahlkopf, who, again, that's not a name we're going to know.
Right.
But he was a friend of Bellum, so I imagine Bellum got him into the Spices or told him about it. Then we get the first Johnny Harding stories, first byline by Mort Lansing. He becomes super prolific under multiple names, but he was really a guy named Bud Long from Texas, and whose name almost never appeared in the pulps, but he had like six or seven pseudonyms in the Spices alone, and then other names in other pulps. And what's interesting, his name surfaced many years ago in a plagiarism suit that Black Mass brought against the Spicy pulps. And the defense was the writer, whose name was Bud Long from Texas, heard this story in a bar and wrote a Spicy story. But it turns out it's semi-plagiarized, the idea, not the words, from a story by a well-known Black Mask writer, W.T. Ballard. And when I first read that, I said, Bud Long from Texas, that sounds so phony.
Doesn't it?
And it wasn't until many years later that we dug up the fact that there was a Bud Long from Texas, and he had, in the industry, a huge reputation for being super prolific. But his name never appeared in the writers' magazines. Editors didn't talk about him. He died during World War II, so his life came to a premature ending. So there was no after career interviews or whatever. But he was a major writer for the Spices, and no one knew these six different names, and these various series characters were really one fantastically prolific guy who was also Carrie Moran and a bunch of other names.
Yes, okay.
And when, after that plagiarism, all those pseudonyms disappear and a whole flock of new ones pop up. But the characters he was writing about continued. So they dumped all his pen names, to, I guess because they told Black Mass, well, we won't use that writer anymore. And they just changed the play lines, and he just kept rolling along.
That sounds like the Spicy line, doesn't it?
It does. Uh-huh. Two of the most prolific guys for the Spicies were Arthur Wallace and Ken Cooper, and we wondered for a long time who they were. Well, it turns out they were Robert Maxwell, who didn't write under his own name for these Spicy Pulps, but wrote for Pep and Spicy Stories. And he ended up being a TV producer. He produced the first season of Superman. He brought Lassie to TV.
Lassie, yeah, he was a Lassie guy.
And
right?
It turns out a number of scripts for Lassie were by Ken Cooper and Arthur Wallace and Robert Maxwell. And so he brought those Spicy names to Lassie and some other TV shows. He did Cannonball, I think, and some other things. So I've been doing a lot of work on the pseudonyms since the 80s, probably, writing about it. And every once in a while, I'll crack another pseudonym. I don't think we'll ever crack them all. And even some of the people behind the pseudonyms are kind of non-entities now, you know. They didn't go on to anything better. Often they went back to some ordinary life when the pulps weren't being published anymore. Very relatively few, I'd say, pulp writers transition to paperback, more probably to hardcover.
Yeah, or to the TV.
The TV. You
TV
know,
and movies.
They did go to TV. A lot of writers went to TV, and which I think was the closest thing to the pulp magazine, because they were half-hour shows.
Very so fast,
And they adapted pretty well to that, the better ones.
One of the things, Will, if you study this and the whole idea of the Spicy or the girly mags sort of dying out and the Spicies coming up, it wasn't really that clean. The girly mags didn't just die out when the Spicy line and the other lines came along. They kept going. In fact, you can find Robert Leslie Bellum's byline in stuff like Silk Stockings magazine from 1939. So those magazines were still around. Their heyday, however, had been before they were blended into genre fiction. Would you say?
Yeah. I think by 40, a lot of those magazines were dead. Although Silk Stocking Stories went to at least 41.
Right.
For whatever reason. But there were crackdowns in 38, 9, and 40, especially in New York, but across the country.
And it hit the shutter pulps as well, like Spicy Mystery.
Yeah,
horror was became much tamer, and so did, of course, Spicy changed to Speed in the early 1940s. The old Spicy line became Speed. Bellum stayed with it, and for those of you who might not know Robert Leslie Bellum's Dan Turner Hollywood Detective, which this is his, what anniversary is this? Is this his 100th anniversary? Is that right? It's 90th. It's his 90th from his appearance.
30.
First appearance, 90 years. So it was first person. They were done in the first person by Robert Leslie Bellum. And a Dan Turner line might go something like, "Behind me, a Roscoe sneezed ka-chow, and a lead pill split the ozone next to my noggin. I ankled the lot, my back pockets dipping gravel." What that meant was someone shot at him and he ran. That was the way, and Will has, in other places, other articles he's written, Will has pointed out people call Dan Turner a parody. In fact, S.J. Perelman wrote a piece called Somewhere a Roscoe. And it's an amazing, I tried to get it when I did the first Dan Turner collection, which was published in 82. I tried to get the S.J. Perelman essay for it and couldn't get it. They wouldn't let me, the Perelman estate wouldn't let me have it. But it you get the idea that he was parodying the hard-boiled style. Will has pointed out, it was not parody. It was beyond parody. He wasn't making fun of anybody. He was just completely out there. It was amazing.
When I started putting the Dan Turner book together, I didn't know that I wasn't aware of pulp fandom. And in those days, in the 70s, this would be the mid-70s to late 70s, I had heard from someone that someone had written some sort of a story about Robert Leslie Bellum. Well, I'd started buying his pulps for 50 cents a piece from a friend who said, "I think you'll like this," knew my taste pretty well. And I thought, these stories have got to be collected. And so I'd heard that he had relatives in Oklahoma. I'm from the Tulsa area. And in Atoka, Oklahoma, where there's coincidentally a major prison. And so I didn't know what to do because all it was, I couldn't track down, it was a xenophile it was in. Okay. And I couldn't track down, I just heard somebody say, "Yeah, I think I saw that." So I wrote to the newspaper in Atoka and asked them if they could, and they published something that this writer was looking for relatives of Robert Leslie Bellum, and I got a letter from his sister-in-law, whose last name was Washburn. Uh-huh. Of course, Hamilton Washburn being one of Robert Leslie Bellum's dozens of pseudonyms. We go out there, a friend of mine and I, and interview this little lady and her husband, of course, wants money, and you know how much money there is in pulps. Will can tell you that, and I can too. And at that time, of course, like I said, this is the late 70s, mid to late 70s, and we said, "Well, we sell the book, I'll send you some," which I did after we sold the book. And the funny thing that I remember the most, do you guys remember the series Vegas with, who was that?
Oh, God.
Robert Ewing, yeah. Thank you, yes. Her husband was completely worked up and convinced that they had stolen the lead character for Vegas from Robert Leslie Bellum. What was his name? Dan Tanna. Dan Tanna, and they were sure he was just, I think maybe I ought to file suit against him, you know, because I think they stole this from Robert Leslie Bellum. So that was, and then I got permission to reprint the stories, and that's how that collection came about. That came out of Popular Press then in 1982. So anyway, that was Bellum, and Bellum is the, I think, undisputed star.
Yeah.
The spicy pulps into the speed pulps. He had spin-offs, Hollywood Detective, Private Detective. In 1947, Republic Pictures put out a Dan Turner film, which I don't think happened with any other spicy characters, did it? As far as you know, any other spicy characters made it to the movies?
Well, Johnny Harding was supposed to be a movie, and if it ever happened, they changed his name. We've never been able to track it down.
But Dan Turner was definitely in a film called Blackmail, not the Alfred Hitchcock film, I hasten to add. And it was he was played by William Marshall, who had been a big band singer. And they were kind of trying to do a Dick Powell thing with him, kind of a minor league Dick Powell thing. And then in 1990, the Dan Turner movie I wrote, based on Homicide Highball by Bellum, came out, but that is a whole nother story because we had to fight. I'm not going to go too deeply into this, except to say that every one of the Bellum-esque things in it worried the producers because they were sure we were making a new Man with Bogart's Face. And Man with Bogart's Face had flopped at the box office. So they would actually take the Bellum, because I took a lot of Bellums. By this time I was pretty much about how Bellum would do dialogue, and they would just deflate it where it wasn't like Bellum. Mark Singer, the Beastmaster, played Dan Turner, and we had a great B-picture cast, Eddie Deason and Paul Bartel and Clu Gulager and a ton of different people. And you can get it, you can see it on YouTube, but don't tell MGM because they think they own it. So there you go. All right.
Spicy Detective was so successful, launching in 1934, that for every year for the next three, the publishers came out with other genre-focused Spicies. The Spicy Adventure, which had to be hyphenated because Adventure Magazine would have sued.
Oh, is that why that's, the hyphen? Oh, yeah. I never knew that. Okay.
Or maybe did so sue but failed. There was a lot of suing going on in that industry, amazingly enough. Then they did Spicy Mystery, which largely was because popular publications had been so successful with horror stories and terror tales of dime mystery. They were like, oh, we got to get into this. It's perfect for us. And for a few years, the joke as the industry is like, what the joke in the industry was, what's next? Spicy Western. And nobody thought they'd do it. Then they did. And that was successful. And then they tried sizzling this and sizzling that. That didn't go anywhere. And then they started, they launched Private Detective in, what, 37, which was just somewhat of a cleaned up Spicy Detective.
More like a Speed Detective.
Yeah. Like, and later it yeah, was called like, Speeds, and we'll get to that.
Yeah.
And so they saved those magazines, sold them to the counter, and I no doubt in some localities they did, but they paid very well in their big circulations because Harry Donenfeld and his people had really good distribution going on. And they had created a market with the pamphlets, so everybody knew what kind of magazines they could produce and who was reading them and what kind of sales they'd have. So, you know, you had a build-up till about 39 and 40. Then the censorship came in and they fought it. They held off for a while. And they started to tame down the magazine. And they had started to tame down, I think, probably as early as 36 or 5. Because they were constantly sending out bullets and saying, oh, you know, we got to watch this stuff about this and anatomical detail. We're not going to do that anymore. You know, the girls have to wear panties and stuff like that. But the same. You know, in other words, one of the great editorial edicts for the Spicy Pulps was you can't have a nude, completely nude woman in the story unless she were dead. Yeah. If she was a murder victim and she lay there nude, that was fine. But if she was living, no. She had to have some shreds of clothes, and that was how they cut their cloth at that point. Then it began to do something odd. They started reprinting stories. And they started reprinting stories and changing the bylines and sometimes changing the title, often changing the title. And yet keeping everything else pretty much the same. And there's a letter from Robert Leslie Bellum telling someone, well, they're starting to reprint some of my older stories, so it's becoming less of a market to me. But it's still a good market. And, you know, I only sold them first rights. They're not supposed to reprint anything without paying me. But I don't think I want to rock this boat. And that's the first clue we have that Bellum knew his stuff was being reprinted. He was basically his old stuff was in competition with his new stuff, which is a thing that happened at certain pulp houses like Fiction House, where the editors would dig into the back issues, dust off a story, change the title, maybe change the byline, maybe change some other factors, and reprint the story as if it's new. And that caused a turmoil in the industry because some of the publishers never did reprints would then say, this is unfair competition. They got the FCC, and was it the FCC? Yeah, FTC.
Mm-hmm.
Federal Trade Commission, thank you, into it. And there was, for years, there was a struggle, and these publishers had to agree to not, you know, reprint stuff unless it was labeled. And they stopped reprinting, except with the Spices and a couple other people. They stopped reprinting for a long time, but near the end of the pulps, when things are getting dicey financially, they started reprinting stuff but labeling it. But so the Spices started to go downhill around 39, 40, and by 41, with the censorship stuff that had already killed the Shutter Pulps and some other things, they had to start calling themselves Speed Detective, Speed Adventure, Speed Mystery, whatever. And they did that. And they carried on through the war and after the war, but it was the rise of the paperback and the rise of TV and probably the rise of post-war girly magazines that were much more frank.
Before we leave Bellum, I do want to say that did you all see the Watchmen TV series a few years ago? You remember that take the beginning of the film has to do with the Tulsa Race Massacre. Robert Leslie Bellum was a photographer
at the Tulsa Race Massacre. You don't know what, because they didn't, he was working for the Tulsa Tribune at the time, that's where he met his wife, and he was mostly selling advertising, as I understand it, at that time. But when this happened, they deputized a bunch of people, sent them down to the Greenwood area, and Robert Leslie Bellum was a photographer. He was deputized and was a photographer and took shots. There is no way of knowing what, we've got tons of those photos, of course, I'm from the Tulsa area, but there's no way of knowing which ones Bellum did. But I just think that, I've always thought that was such an interesting part of his career that really nobody knew much about. Now, also, let's talk, could you talk about the eel? I know I was, when Doug Ellis did his eel books, I was when I became acquainted with the eel. The eel was one of Spicy's big characters. And you want to talk about the eel a little bit?
The eel was by Hugh B. Cave under the name Justin Case, I think for the most part. And he was kind of a slippery, by the court of the name, you know, con artist, crook kind of character. You know, the kind of, you know, lovable rogue that they used to do in Great Britain in an earlier generation. And he was very successful. And this brings to mind one of the interesting things about how they ran these magazines. You not only had most of the writers writing for most of the magazines. For instance, you know, Lawrence Donovan, who was the Doc Savage ghost, wrote for Spicy Detective, but also Spicy Western and Spicy Adventure, but maybe not Spicy Mystery. There were some writers who didn't seem to want to be in some of the magazines that weren't to their taste. Well, it was true also the characters. The eel, I believe, first appeared in Spicy Detective, but it wasn't long before he was in Spicy Adventure. Mm-hmm. And he, I don't think he was in Spicy Mystery, and certainly wasn't in Spicy Western. But a number of these characters jumped around from the different magazines, and sometimes the editors would forget put the correct byline on. And this is how we know the true identities of some of the writers, because sometimes the byline didn't match across the series. And sometimes the byline wasn't the same on the contents page as the cover or as the first page of the story. So the mask would slip through sloppy editing. And Eel was one of those guys. I think some of E. Hoffman Price's detective characters jump back and forth between Private Detective and Spicy Detective, but that's a natural thing. The first Private Detective had a lead novel with Dan Turner, who later got his own magazine, mm-hmm. Dan Turner Hollywood Detective. That's how popular.
Yeah, which simply became Hollywood Detective after, what, 10 issues, 8 issues, can't remember. Yeah,
relatively quickly.
Right, right.
And so there's a lot of cross-pollination. And they must have incredible manuscript files, because when they were putting these magazines, one of the problems for an editor putting together any kind of magazine or genre was to avoid duplication. If your lead story in Spicy Detective was a kidnapping story, you probably didn't want another kidnapping. You wanted a jewel thief story, or this story or that story, you know, a revenge story. And so they had to have a lot of inventory to slap together an issue of anything. And so maybe the eel ended up in Spicy Adventure because they were just desperate to fill a hole, and the story was sort of more detective than adventure, but what the hell, we gotta get this issue to the presses.
Right.
So they bought heavily from their favorite writers, and they bought from other writers where they could find what they wanted. There's an article by, I think it's C. Samuel Campbell, but don't quote me, when someone in a writer's magazine said, I was looking at the spicy pulps as a market, and it's clear that one person writes every issue. Well, that's not true. So C. Samuel Campbell, wrote an article or a long letter that was published almost like an article because it was so long. He said, this is not true. I'm a contributor, so is my friend Saul W. Paul, so is my other friend Grant Milton now. Musselman, I forget his last name. Musselman, I think. Sassaman, Grant Milton Sassaman, who would take his name and chop it up in all sorts of ways for different bylines. And he said, well, we all Philadelphia writers, we know each other, we contribute to these magazines, and I tell you, we're real people, and what's happening is the editors tell us how we can, how we write the stories, what to watch out for, but none of us are perfect. We all have our own little spin in our stories. So they go through the manuscripts and they copy edit them so that they conform to the current standard, which sometimes changes. So you have a lot of similar types of descriptions, not necessarily identical descriptions, but they have the same feel and they have the same approach describing a woman's bosom or a...
Which there were certain terms you could not use.
Yeah, and there were certain terms that were euphemistically acceptable.
Yeah, right.
So it was the editor's job to make sure to enforce that conformity because they were selling these magazines to the mails where they could and getting a lot of pushback from the post office.
Except for Dan Turner, would his two that I remember right off the top of my head were Tiddlywinks and Bonbons. I don't know that any other of the spicy writers used those particular euphemisms. We need to talk, in the time we have left a little bit, I think, about the comic strips in the spicies. Because spicy, and I learned this first from Will and from reading them, the spicies had more illustrations than really any other pulp that was out at that particular time. Much more illustration. These included comic strips. And in Spicy Detectives, it was a comic strip called Sally the Sleuth. Now, Sally the Sleuth was a creation of Adolph Barrow and his Majestic Studios, which I believe is in Chicago, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm not sure.
Was it out of Chicago? I think so, but I'm not positive. But anyway, Sally the Sleuth, basically, the story was that she would get in some sort of a mess, kidnappers or something, and lose her clothes. That was basically the entire plot of every Sally the Sleuth in Spicy Detective. She was aided by her boss, who was called the Chief, and then by a kid named Peanuts, which I think Peanuts was sort of they figured was a projected kind of adolescent fantasy thing, except that he never got fresh at all with Sally the Sleuth. In fact, if he found himself like accidentally grabbing her when she fell out of a window, and the Chief said something, well, Peanuts, how about that? Hey, my gang would make fun of me. It would be like it was the weirdest kind of situation triangle that they had going on. And I didn't realize until I read an interview some time ago with C.C. Beck, who did Captain Marvel. He said one of the reasons that comic books supplanted the pulps, and I never thought about this, was that the comic strips eliminated the need for typesetting. They eliminated the need for the composing room. They eliminated the need for a number of things because the artists could do all of those things. They could letter, they could do everything. And so it was much more cost effective to do a comic strip than it was to do a prose story. And I don't know how, I didn't ask you about this. I don't know how much of a factor that was with the pulps being, comics being at least part of what brought the pulps down. But, I mean, do you think that was a factor?
Yeah, I think it was part of it, but there's a countervailing thing, which is you had to have color interiors, and that was more expensive. But what really did the job on the pulps was the combination of comics and paperback novels of that time. Because if you're a guy with a newsstand, you can put 20 comics in the same rack as maybe 7 pulps, because the comics were thinner.
Okay.
And it was the same dime or 15 cents. And so if you could put more copies on one rack and sold most or all of them, it's a lot better selling 20 comics than 7 pulp magazines, you know? Okay. And they were easier to restock. They didn't get damaged as easily because they had trimmed edges. And And you, in comics, you didn't have a painter doing the covers. You had the same guys who did the interior, so you're saving money there.
Right, right.
They might have gotten the same page rate for a cover, or maybe a little better, but not much better.
Yeah.
So there's the economics of what the newsstand guys were dealing with. There was a big glut of magazines post-war in like 47, 48, 49. Just absolutely killed a lot of publishers. Because everybody went into magazine publishing thinking the boom days of the war would continue. But a lot of that stuff was selling to Army PXs and going overseas and being read by, you know, the wives and girlfriends of servicemen overseas to fill their dead time. And so when they threw out all these new magazines, a lot of them were sent back unopened, unread, unmarketed. Because the stands were overflowing with bundles of new magazines, including comics. So everybody got hurt. Mm-hmm. And there was a big pullback. And so that was part of the softening up of the pulps. The Korean War came along and suddenly the pulps were selling again because the Army PXs were booming again. And then the war ended and they killed the pulps again. And then TV was there.
Yeah.
So we have all that.
All right, I see, we'll take a couple questions here in a minute, but I see that you have something over here that we probably need to show the folks.
The editor of the early Spicy Pulps, Frank Armour, had been a publisher, and he did a short-lived pulp called Zeppelin Stories, and many years ago, as a joke, I wrote Spicy Zeppelin Stories. What could be more suggestive? And so instead of focusing on aviation stories as such, you know, the lead novel is sort of a Doc Savage type, and there's a Western story, and there's a spy story, and an aviation story, and a Shutter story, et cetera, et cetera. So this is all genres, you know, under the Spicy Zeppelin.
May I give some titles, a couple of titles here? I've got the first one, as you well know, when it first came out. Gas Bag Buckaroo. Zeps of the Void.
Science fiction.
And Catwalk Creeper.
Shudder.
Yes, just three of the stories that await you in Spicy Zeppelin Stories. Yes, Michelle?
Yeah, well, I think your points on vanishing into pulps regarding comics and paperbacks are very well made. But what I really think destroyed the pulps, people forget, commercial TV didn't exist in any real form until the last year of the 1940s, 48, 49.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I said and that. TV was the death blow.
And 49, 50. Those 2 years, and I remember those 2 years as a baby, vaguely, and those 2 years just destroyed the pulps in so many ways because the stories on television were every bit the same content and character as the pulps. But what really destroyed the pulps later was the fact that American readers have consistently, throughout my lifetime, which I'm 76, American readers have been getting dumber and dumber and dumber and dumber. And we've reached this, I'm not talking about older people, but the generations, and we've reached the stage now where I've worked in the media my whole career, over 58 years, and now, the number of people I see in restaurants reading a newspaper or a magazine under 40 is almost non-existent. And the people who read pulps, many of them were under 40.
Well, the thing that doomed the pulps to a significant degree, that dooms the newspapers, is they're now considered old technology.
Right.
You know, the pulp was the pulp magazine was a pretty clumsy product. It was fat, it was thick. And it never grew in terms, it never went to like better paper or color interior. Newspapers are struggling by adding color interior and doing things, but it's still a newspaper and it's yesterday's news today.
Right, and one thing more, the pulps in themselves. In the 50s, there were comic book collectors like me, not very many. I started in 56 at age 8. And my teacher even said, "You're a what? A comic book collector? I never heard of such a thing." But I never met any pulp magazine collectors until the 70s, because pulps were just not collected. And I still think for every collector of old comics, whether you're talking about the 70s, the 40s, or anything, I think there's 100 of those compared to every pulp collector. You know, the number of pulp collectors is very small.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Quick question. You mentioned, I'm just curious, I want to know about this. What kind of circulation does spices have during the run of spices?
I don't know that we know.
Really?
Because I don't know that they published this.
They were never in ABC.
Yeah, okay.
Never were on?
Okay. I'm going to guess 200,000 plus.
For that whole, all four titles?
No, individually. But I wouldn't speak to, I would say, let's say, Spicy Detective, the leader.
Okay.
I'm going to guess that, just as a rough guess, because the speed at which they brought out these companion magazines meant that they weren't floating around the 150 mark, which some pulps floated at, just barely staying alive. It had to be 200,000 plus. It could have been 250 plus. The Shadow, I think, tops was like 300,000 for a while and leveled off about 250, 275. Doc Savage, I think, was 250 plus. That's when you knew you were making money, you know? And they paid well. They wouldn't be paying well if they weren't selling well.
That's true, because that's one of the fallacies about the spices, is that they were a low-paying market. They weren't a low-paying market, as I understand it, right?
No. I mean, it may have been low-paying to certain writers, but Bellum, whatever his top rate, and I'm going to guess it's two cents.
Probably.
I'm going to guess
that.
Yeah,
that's a good guess.
Some of the others are getting 2 cents. The other guys are getting 1.5 to 1 cent. Not too many half-centers in there, probably, because, you know, they needed a lot of material. And they were, since they were doing so many magazines, they needed material that didn't need to be heavily copy edited to be able to be published, because it wasn't just story quality, it was conformity to the prevailing limitations that were imposed. Yes, yeah, Bob.
In the movies, you had the Hays Code come in 1934.
Okay.
Before that, you had some bare breasts in movies.
Yep.
In the pulps, you had the girly pulps, had some bare breasts on covers in the 30s. And spicy pulps, although it refers to sexuality, you know, kind of. What were the censorship, either laws, regulations, or self-imposed standards that the spices dealt with?
Well, I think they were getting pushback from the Postal Service, as well as church groups and youth groups and whatever.
And Mayor LaGuardia, too.
Mayor LaGuardia, that was later. Yeah.
It depended on the location, because you'll look at Spicy's, they'll have stars on the covers, and those would be toned down illustrative-wise. Hmm. And even Doc Savage would have the stars on the covers, and then all of the patent medicine ads suddenly became house ads. So based on where it was being, you know, sold, it would depend on...
It was a patchwork, sort of like the censorship before the MPAA, you know, GPG thing. It was a patchwork. I've talked to a lot of exploitation filmmakers who had to do different things to get, like, Boston past the Boston censors or past. So it was kind of a crazy quilt like that.
I think you just hit on something. Maybe the emergence of the Hays Code in movies meant they were opening up that market. For if you can't see the kind of movies you want, you can read about them.
Yeah,
you know, if you
point.
Can't,
I never thought about
yeah,
that.
I never thought of that either.
Well, you mentioned Doc Savage and the Shadow, but with the spices being across, you know, so many different genres, are you aware, was there ever any consideration of a spicy hero pulp?
Yeah, well, Super Detective, which had Jim Anthony and Doc Savage imitation, that was a spicy detective pulp. They talked about a spicy science fiction, but they never did it, so they dumped that inventory into Spicy Adventure.
Plus the Lone Ranger.
Yep. They had the Lone Ranger who wasn't spicy.
But neither of those, and really Jim Anthony was not, it was the same publishing house, but Jim Anthony wasn't a spice, it wasn't sexed up, as the term went. That's it. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, Mike.
You've been listening to Pulp Tales, fascinating stories of the pulp magazines and the creative minds that brought them to life. Brought to you by The Pulp Net. Learn more about the pulp magazines through articles, blogs, bibliographies, links, Over 100 episodes of this podcast and much more at the PulpNet. Your link to the Pulp magazines for almost 30 years. Online at thepulp.net. Subscribe to Pulp Tales on your favorite podcast platform or listen to us on the web at thepulp.net. If you enjoy our content, please like us or leave us a review. And tell your fellow pulp fans about Pulp Tales. Thank you for listening and keep reading the pulps. Pulp Tales is copyright 2024 by William P. Lampkin.